We're back on This Old Car Radio, and right now we're pleased to be joined on the line by Jeff Mollen. For those of you who saw the May 29th cover story in Old Cars Weekly, you'll know that Jeff is the grandson of George Schuster, who was one of the participants in the famed 1908 Great Race, and George was on the winning entry, the famous Thomas Flyer, that somehow survived that around-the-world journey from New York to Paris. And Jeff has written a book on that famous race and is sort of an insider historian on this subject, because he got to hear a lot of tales about the Great Race from his grandfather when he was young. Jeff, thanks for joining us on This Old Car Radio. Hey, I've got to believe that when you get to talk to people about this subject, about the Great Race, sometimes that's got to be sort of a one-sided conversation in a lot of cases, because not too many people around probably got to talk to or know somebody who was in that race. And I guess it goes without saying that that had to be pretty cool to hear tales of adventure like that straight from the source, somebody who was in the race. Not too many people really have probably had that opportunity.
Well, you're right. And, of course, my great-grandfather, George Schuster, lived to the age of 99. So growing up as a young boy, of course, was like any youngster. It was old great-gramps telling another story, and we were off to play. But by about my middle teens, I began to realize that this was history from the man who lived it, and was far better than anything I was hearing on TV and Gunsmoke or Perry Mason. So the fascination quickly grew, and of course it was well into my 20s before he passed, so I had an opportunity to really begin to appreciate and understand what he was saying.
Kind of, what was your great-grandfather's take on the whole affair? I mean, did he get all worked up when he talked about this race? I mean, did he get excited about telling the tales? Was he low-key about it? Kind of, what was, how did he act when he talked about this? And, you know, how excitable was he when he talked about, you know, recalling that race to you?
Well, it was a race today, even today, it was of epic proportions. I don't think there are many people who would even attempt it today, literally going cross-country from New York City to Paris and using the Bering Strait as a frozen ice bridge across the Pacific Ocean. I mean, it's beyond Jules Verne when you talk about it. Of course, sitting at the starting line, they thought that this was actually going to happen. And I think that at least for the first few decades during the race and the first few decades after, he always felt that it was pretty much part of the job. He was, like many early Americans at the turn of the century, very dedicated, very determined, sort of a can-do attitude that it would be hard for us to imagine today. The resourcefulness and the Yankee ingenuity were all there, and of course that's what won the West and developed America. It wasn't until probably the restoration of the car by Bill Hara, and that's a story in itself, but
right.
When the car was discovered and great-grandpa was asked to come out to authenticate it, his first response to Mr. Hara was that he had seen the car before in the Austin Clark Museum in Long Island, and prior to that had looked at it, and many changes had been made, many exterior changes, and he felt that it was a 1907 Model 35, but it wasn't the one that he drove to Paris. Of course, after the authentication was made and the car was restored, he had an opportunity to drive it, and actually over some of the very same roads going down to Tonopah, Nevada, that he'd driven during the race. And I think it was at that moment that he began to reflect on the intervening decades and what had happened to the automobile as a means of transportation. It had gone from a rich man's toy that was only driven in the summertime by the very wealthy to part of everyday life for every American. Interstate highways and all of the things that we just take for granted today weren't even dreamed of in 1908. And I think it was then, for the first time, that he really realized what he had done and what the American car had done. It had won a race that most people thought, if anybody was able to accomplish it, it would have been the superior, what were considered the superior European cars of 1908, certainly not an American car. Matter of fact, Henry Ford and Ransom Olds flatly turned down the notion of even entering a car in the New York to Paris race, because at that time, in 1908, no automobile had ever even driven across the United States right. in the wintertime, much less drive from New York to Paris.
As long as we're kind of on the subject here, Jeff, of the car itself, you know, although I guess pretty primitive by today's standards, that 1907 Thomas Flyer really turned out to be a great car for the times. It was a big, sturdy car with a four-cylinder engine. How did that car hold up overall during that race, and what were your great-grandfather's memories of what it was like to drive that car and how it kind of held up during that event? What did he talk about when he started talking about the car itself?
Well, the Thomas Flyer did have a great reputation as an automobile. I mean, it was expensive. It was a $4,500 automobile, which cost more than most houses did in those days.
Right.
And it ranked right up there with Pierce Arrow and the others. As a matter of fact, I think that was probably largely the reason that at the very last moment, B.R. Thomas, who was the head of the Thomas Company, was encouraged to enter a car in the race by then-President Teddy Roosevelt. Of course, anybody knowing Teddy Roosevelt knew that when he heard that there were going to be Germans, Italians, and French racing horseless carriages across the United States, Teddy really didn't care which American manufacturer entered a car, but there would be an American in that competition. Well, the day before the race started, of course, Great-Gramp was up in Providence, Rhode Island, and got a call from the office saying that ER had decided to enter a car in the race, and he was to be in New York City at Times Square the very next morning to start a race around the world. So there was no preparation. There was nothing special about the Thomas Flyer, unlike the other cars, the German Protos, which was built by 600 Germans in 14 days specifically for this race. This was like building the space shuttle for Germany. Very intense nationalistic effort in that competitor. And, of course, the French, with their three automobiles and the Zeus, all had months of preparation. Well, the Thomas itself actually fared quite well. There were the normal problems crossing most of the United States. They had a problem with a spark plug and that sort of thing. But it really, I think, demonstrates the durability of the automobile. It wasn't until they got to a place called Twin Springs Ranch in Nevada, where they were going through a river crossing, and the river had quicksand in it and boulders. There were no bridges in those days. So as they were crossing this, they started to come up the opposite bank that they had entered on, and there was sort of a crunch and a grind, and suddenly the Flyer stopped moving, and they had to actually strip pinion teeth out of the pinion gear. Well, there were no dealers or parts places in those days, so Great-Gramp recalled that 75 miles away in Tonopah, Nevada, there was a doctor who owned a Thomas Flyer that had been delivered a year earlier. And so he started out walking the 75 miles to pick up spare parts. He finally got the part. Actually, the doctor said, take whatever you need out of my car. So he removed the good pinion gear from the doctor's car, taking it back the 75 miles. And then in the creek bed, they had to tunnel out underneath, and he slid in on his back in the mire of the quicksand as the car was slowly sinking, replaced the gear, and they got it out. Once again, the pinion gear failed in Siberia, but this time there was no doctor's car. There was probably no Thomas Flyer within 10,000 miles. So they actually took the pinion gear. They drove metal screws into the shaft of the pinion gear, filed them into the shape of a gear tooth, and off they went. The resourcefulness of these guys, when there weren't what we consider the normal support system that we've got today in parts stores and welding shops and fabrication places and all of the things that you'd need today, they didn't have, but they certainly didn't let that stop them. There was no obstacle that was considered insurmountable. Whatever it took, they would overcome it.
I got to think one of the most, when you look back at period photos of that race, Jeff, one of the most shocking things that I find about the whole thing is you see these guys out in the elements and out in the weather bundled up in these open cars. I mean, I don't know about you, but if it's 50 miles an hour, I got the windows up in my car, and I'm probably running the heater. I mean, these guys had, like, no protection from the elements. There had to be some serious misery involved a lot of the time here. How did these guys handle that type of exposure for so many weeks? I mean, they were out there for 6 months, from February through July. I mean, I wouldn't have a prayer handling anything like that. There'd have been a lot of whimpering if I'm in the car at that point. How did these guys manage to avoid freezing to death on some of these days?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, of course, in 1908, glass was considered too dangerous, and so there weren't windshields on the cars. As a matter of fact, the Thomas Fire didn't even have doors on it. And one of the problems, actually, it was in Russia, as they were approaching Moscow, they were trying to catch up with the Germans. So they were driving 24 hours a day. There was a New York Times reporter in the back seat covering the story, and that's why it's photographically so well documented today. But two of them were unloaded onto a train and sort of paralleled the route of the car while George Miller and Great Gramp were driving nonstop. And that was actually a big part of the problem, because the rider, and of course in those days the rider would have been in the left seat, had a tendency when he'd fall asleep to fall out of the car. So they actually invented the seat belt. Now, it was a man's belt cut in half, and it was nailed to both sides of the seat. And it's in the car today. You can actually see the seat belt on the rider's seat. And it wasn't to prevent injury in a collision. It was to keep you in the car while you were trying to get a little bit of sleep from falling out. Medically, you're right. It's amazing. No one died in this race. Actually, of the six cars that began the race in Times Square, three of them incredibly finished in Paris. Of course, the winning time was 169 days to cover the 22,000 miles. And during that time, illness was a pretty common problem. Matter of fact, dysentery frequently happened. And they did receive a medical kit when they got to Seattle. Dr. Shaw actually approached Great Gramp and said, "George, you know, what happens if one of you gets sick? What do you do?" And they hadn't really given that a lot of thought. They didn't even have what today we would consider a first aid kit. So Dr. Shaw gave him a small case, and it had in about a dozen vials, and it contained all of the wonder drugs of the day, morphine and things like that. And then there was a little hand-lettered book, and on page 9 was headache. And then it would tell you how much of vial number 2 to take for a headache. Well, dysentery, of course, they used up whatever they had for dysentery. So Great Gramp found that a great remedy for that was he would take a pint of whatever the local beverage was. If they were in the West, it'd be whiskey. If they were in Siberia, it'd be vodka. Drink that down as fast as he could, and then he would get out behind the car, and he would run after the car as it was going forward, until he broke into a sweat. Then he would get into the car, fall asleep, and when he woke up, the dysentery was cured. I guess the remedy works pretty well. I don't know how many people would go through that process to get rid of it, but it was that type of endurance and, again, this sort of can-do attitude that even in adversity like disease got them through. And as you said, I don't know many people today who would even attempt something like that, much less be able to accomplish it.
Jeff, the Great Race was supposed to be resurrected this year, a version of the race to celebrate its 100th anniversary. In fact, it was supposed to start last month and run from New York to Paris, but unfortunately Chinese authorities kind of put up a roadblock and pulled everybody's credentials, so to speak, and they banned the race from coming through that country, and the race had to be scrapped for this year. The good news is it's been rescheduled for next spring. I'm sure you're going to be an interested spectator in that event. What's your take on the idea of rerunning it, and any plans to jump in a car yourself and give it a try someday?
Oh, yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'll be part of the 2009 New York to Paris event. I've been working with the Great Race folks doing the historic perspective of the race. And actually, the 2009 event will be very true to form with the route that was taken in 1908. So I think it'll be an exciting competition, and that'll be in the rally format. Discussions now are actually going on doing something as an event in 2008. Of course, it won't be through China or through Europe, but doing something here in the States that would be from East Coast to West Coast to commemorate the event. And then, as I say, the New York to Paris event will take off in April the 25th of 2009 from New York City Times Square. So it's too bad, and of course, international politics being what they are, it's sad when that hampers a celebration of something that happened 100 years ago. But I guess that's all part of living in the 21st century.
But Jeff Mull, we really appreciate your insights on this great event in motoring history. Like very much to continue this conversation maybe later in the summer when the official 100th anniversary takes place. Again, we really appreciate your time this morning. Thanks for joining us on this Soul Car Radio.
Well, thank you. And for any of the listeners who are looking for additional information, real easy to find online, www.thegreatautorace.com. And that includes many of the stories and some of the photographs that you were talking about, and which your viewers might find of particular interest.
Terrific. Thanks again, Jeff. We appreciate it. We'll be back with more right after this on This Old Car Radio.